You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done, and by union what we will can be accomplished still, drops of water turn a mill, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig PA and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefit funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124 supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905, and if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, if you're working class and you're wondering if the political class has done anything for you lately, tune in tonight. We're going to have Representative Sharice Davids and Kansas AFL-CIO's John Nave, who will explain what's in it for you in recent bills passed by Congress. We'll talk infrastructure, the cost of drugs, saving the planet, and yes, inflation. In the news, UMKC's new paid time off shell game, and Staten Island Amazon Union wins at NLRB. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Blackman, and she's going to be remembering the Patco strike. And now for the news.
The NLRB has released its report on the challenged Amazon Fulfillment Center, aka Warehouse, union election on Staten Island. This is the one the workers won as an independent union and the NLRB found in their favor. The election was held March 25th through 30th this year at the JFK 8 facility. The union won by 523 votes, a wide margin. Nevertheless, Amazon challenged the vote, saying illegal conduct had occurred and the election should be run. After 24 days of hearings, the administrative law judge ruled against Amazon, saying it had not met its burden of proof that the conduct by neither the NLRB nor anyone else had engaged in objectionable conduct affecting the results of the election. She then ruled that the Amazon labor union should be certified as the bargaining representative for the workers in the warehouse. Amazon has until September 16th to appeal.
Yesterday, the University of Missouri System Board of Curators unanimously passed a new paid time off plan, which takes away 10 of the total number of work days off that are paid while adding 4 weeks of paid parental leave and 2 weeks paid to care for an immediate family member. It also will give up to 21 weeks off for a short-term disability leave at 60% of pay, with the ability to use PTO to reach 100% if they want. This plan, which the administration has touted as a move to attract more workers, in effect reduces total paid time off. The Columbia Daily Tribune gives this example. A new hourly employee in the UM system currently is granted 12 days of vacation, 12 days of sick leave, 4 personal days, 4 days of winter break, and 9 paid holidays. That totals 41 days. When the new plan begins, a new hourly worker will get 18 days of paid leave. The policy applies to all staff, but not faculty. We wonder how this new plan will really make the university, with its notoriously low wages for staff, an attractive place to work. So how was this greeted by staff? On Tuesday, at a rally in front of the student union, there was a chorus of boos. The rally was organized by LIUNA Local 955, which represents service and maintenance staff, including custodial employees on the UMKC and MU campuses. All other university workers are unrepresented. That didn't stop Kim Jarrett from financial aid coming out and speaking. Here's Kim.
I'm losing 10 days. And you know the thing is, you know what they're going to give me instead? They are going to give me child bonding and elderly parent. Y'all, I just turned 60. If I have a baby, we're naming Jesus, okay? And my 89-year-old dad married a younger woman. He's good. He wants her to change his diapers, okay? So we're good. So what's happening is they're going to give me short-term disability, but you know what I get with short-term disability? I get 60% of my pay. Oh, I can pay more and get 80%, but I already have 356 sick days that they want to take away from me. But I earned those. I've been here 8 years, and I don't think they know what they're voting on tomorrow. Here's what I've heard. Accrued vacation should be able to roll over. If someone exhausted their short-term disability, they might allow them to use the previous sick time. It could pay the 40% that you're not going to get with the short-term disability. It's staff. It's not faculty. Just us. So personal days are going away by 4. What's the savings to UMKC? 10%. So that means that UMKC is saving 10%. I'm losing something. There's a one-week wait on the short-term disability, so I'm not going to get paid for that. So short-term disability, I get less money, and I don't get paid for that week. Upon the retirement, they were talking about only having 10 days of carryover, and we'd be paid out 100% of retirement. Oh, they bumped that up. It's 20 days of accrual, but now we can only be paid out 10 days of retirement.
Evidently, the curators weren't listening. The policy will go into effect January of 2024. What will happen to accrued sick leave and vacation time is unclear, but it was stated at the Board of Curators meeting that employees won't be able to use the accrued sick leave until all of their PTO has been exhausted. Word on the street is that the Health Science Library at the UMKC School of Medicine has been closed all day, and circulation is so understaffed that they can't function, according to an anonymous librarian. No explanation as to why so many staff didn't report to work. Librarians will be covered by the new PTO policy.
On August 1st, approximately 120 members of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Miller, the BCTGM, Local 100G in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, went on strike against Ingredient Corporation. The company is attempting to gut seniority rights, outsource bargaining unit jobs, and make drastic changes to benefits and working conditions, including work hours and scheduling. The members want a new collective bargaining agreement, and what they want is simple: dignity and respect on the job that comes from a union contract negotiated in good faith and without takeaways. You can help them by sending an email to the CEO and company representatives telling them to get back to the bargaining table and negotiate in good faith. Workers deserve nothing less than respect and dignity on the job. Workers want a collective bargaining agreement that protects what they already have: vacation days, a seniority system, good benefits, safe working conditions, and a schedule that allows them a decent wage while preserving time with their family. Go online to bctgm.org and scroll down to the Ingredient message. Tonight's news was read by Judy Morgan, Ariana Blockman, and I'm Tom Gebkin.
Where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Oh, where the deer and the antelope play.
I am Tom Gepkin, president of CWA Local 6360, and I will be co-hosting tonight's show with Judy Morgan, termed out state rep and president emeritus of AFT Local 691. We are honored to have a member of Congress on tonight's show. Representative Sharice Davids will be our guest. She represents Kansas' 3rd District, which includes a sizable portion of the Kansas City Metro. Representative Davids is the vice chair of the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. She serves on the Committee on Small Business, the Committee on Agriculture, the Joint Economic Committee, and the House Steering and Policy Committee, as well as the Regional Whip. Representative Davids was raised by a single parent who served in the Army for 20 years. After graduating from Leavenworth High School, she worked her way through Johnson County Community College and the University of Missouri of Kansas City before earning a law degree from Cornell Law School. As a first-generation college student, she worked the entire time she was in college. She became one of the first two Native American women to serve in Congress. Representative Davids is a resident of Roland Park. Representative Davids, Judy and I want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to get to talk to you all today.
So I'm going to ask the first question, and it has to do with the Biden administration passing a lot of legislation that benefits working people. So let's first start with some of the most important ones, the infrastructure law. It's been about 10 months since it was passed. And how is it impacting our community in the Kansas City region?
That's a great question, and something that I can tell you I was excited and honored and just enthusiastic, just all the things, because, you know, if you think about all the different ways, whether, let's just take roads, for example, like the infrastructure law is going to fund 94 highway projects in Kansas this year. And we know that there's going to be more to come. And in fact, I was just, it's probably top of mind for me because I just was down in Miami County where K-68 is at. And that's actually a pretty dangerous road. And that project, the improvements and safety features of that project have just advanced to the construction stage. The advancement of that project was made possible because we passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And then if you think about even past roads, water infrastructure, you know, ensuring that we've got clean drinking water, that we've got the systems in place so we can have safety from flooding that we know impacts this area. Being able to fix bridges, being able to expand broadband, all of these things are essential functions for our community to be able to get to where we need to go to stay safe. And all of those things, because of this bipartisan infrastructure law, we know are going to lead to good paying jobs. And when I say that, you know, we know that we're going to see that lead to good paying union jobs. And so I think the bipartisan infrastructure law, just the impact that it's going to have is it's going to last for a long time, that impact.
Would you say that it equally benefits urban, suburban, and rural areas so that the money is actually being spread equally among different communities that need it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that what we're seeing, I like to use the words and combination equal and equitable distribution of those funds, because the needs, broadband access, improved roads, safe bridges, those are needs that whether you're in an urban, suburban, or rural area, those are needs. But it does depend on where you're at, which needs are higher and more immediate. And so I think the bipartisan infrastructure law did a good job of making sure that rural communities are not being left out or not being taken into account. And the same with urban communities. You know, I think we talk a lot about rural broadband, and we should be, because there are a lot of areas that don't have the broadband that they need. And, you know, especially for education for farmers in the rural areas, that's really necessary, and things like telehealth. In the urban areas, we also know that there are pockets of areas where there's no broadband yet. And so I think that the bipartisan infrastructure bill does a good job of making sure that the communities that have been underinvested in for too long are that, you know, part of the metrics are making sure that those communities get the resources that they need.
One of the things of bringing rural broadband or broadband to rural Kansas is it's going to stop the brain drain where younger people are moving to a metropolitan area because they have what they want.
One of the things that I think has been very interesting, the pandemic has been so hard for so many people. And none of us wanted to have to deal with a pandemic, the public health crisis, the economic crisis that has followed, all of that stuff has been, it's just been a lot. But we also are learning a lot of things because of the steps we had to take. And so, Tom, you're mentioning the brain drain. There are places that people want to live, but because they don't have access to the healthcare, or they're not able to run their business or do the things that they want to be able to do, is going to be much more possible if we get the infrastructure investments done that we, you know, that we passed in this infrastructure bill. And, you know, people have called this a once in a lifetime investment, or once in a generation investment in infrastructure. And while I'm very glad that I got to be part of passing the literally the largest infrastructure investment we've ever made in our country, I don't want this to be a once in a generation investment. We need to make sure that we're continuously investing in not just the physical infrastructure, but also in the people who are doing the work. And I think that's another piece of this that I think, you know, when you think about the bipartisan infrastructure bill, there's a few major goals that we had. And one is, of course, to create good paying jobs. Another is to tackle, you know, our climate crisis that we're seeing. And then the third is to set the foundation for long-term economic growth. And when you think about long-term economic growth, you can't do that without thinking about workers and their families. You have to be thinking about ensuring that the critical labor standards like Davis-Bacon or protecting wages for millions of workers are in there. And then you have to make sure that, you know, things like the materials that we're using as much as possible are made in America. And then making sure that the good paying quality jobs, as we look forward into the future, that that those clean energy, renewable, resilient investments go toward good union jobs.
Speaking of all the pro-worker policies, would you discuss those policies in this infrastructure law?
Yeah, so I think the stuff that I mentioned about, you know, the vast majority of those investments are going to be subject to the labor standards, things like Davis-Bacon, prevailing wage. And then I think the piece about the Made in America provisions is another example of being not just pro domestic manufacturing, which is a huge thing that we're, you know, is at the top of mind for a lot of people, particularly with our supply chain issues. But also, you know, that is a compounding effect of employing people in good paying jobs here at home. And that's something that we have unfortunately seen for too many years. A lot of that manufacturing has moved overseas. And we find ourselves competing with countries like, particularly like China, where we know that manufacturing that we can do here is higher quality on a lot of the things that particularly in infrastructure needs, whether we're talking about cement or all the other types of infrastructure materials that we need.
Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're talking to Representative Charisse Davids, who represents the 3rd District in Kansas in our U.S. Congress. Just last month, the president signed the CHIPS Act, CHIPS and Science Act, into law, passing incentives for domestic manufacturing and growing our STEM workforce. So first off, I always like to know what do those acronyms stand for. So what does CHIPS stand for? And what are the major components of the bill? And it's my understanding that you had something to do with getting it passed. So let's talk about all of that.
This is kind of funny, actually. CHIPS is about semiconductor chips. So it's one of the few times that we in Congress didn't have some very long, convoluted name. But I think that, you know, the focus on our supply chain issues is something that since the beginning of the pandemic have really had to come to terms with. You know, making sure that we are unsticking the supply chain, making sure that we're bringing costs down, making sure that people can actually get what they need. At the beginning of the pandemic, we were looking at things like personal protective equipment, mm-hmm. you know, and making sure that people were able to stay safe. All our frontline folks, and I use that term very broadly, because whether you were working in construction, whether you were in the medical profession, teachers, people at the postal service. I mean, there were a lot of folks who were still physically going into work every single day and needed to get personal protective equipment. And our supply chain issues led to some real problems there. And so the CHIPS and Science Act is actually geared toward getting at the root of that. We want to make sure that we're making more here domestically. And of course, I particularly, I'm biased. I think we can make, there's a lot of things that we can make here in Kansas that can address some of those inflation issues and help bring costs down for folks. And I was really glad that we were able to get this bill done in a bipartisan way, because it's going to help make sure that the areas where semiconductor chips and, you know, semiconductor chips go into almost everything that we do, our phones, washers and dryers. I mean, you know, our cars, everything. And so I'm really glad we were able to get this done, because in the long term, for us to compete on the global stage or continue to be a leader, we have to make sure that we're doing as much of those critical pieces here at home. And I was on the conference committee, and I got a chance to be part of the negotiations to ensure that some of those critical pieces were included, and making sure that folks know everywhere is impacted. The General Motors plant here in Fairfax was idled for months and months because of the chip shortage.
So is the conference committee similar to like when I was in the Missouri State House, mm-hmm. a bill would go to both sides of the legislature and there would be differences, and then the conference committee meets and they actually work out all the nitty gritty of what the bill is going to end up being. So you had a chance to actually be on that committee that did that work, that worked out all those kinks in the bill.
I think in years past, it sounds like the conference committee process has actually not been used as much on as many bills. It definitely still gets used for the defense authorization bill and a few others, but having a conference committee put together for the CHIPS and Science Act, I think was an indication of just how important it was to all of us. And so, you know, I had the chance to both, you know, testify, I don't know if testify is the right word, but essentially alongside my colleagues, you know, I sat next to Senator Warnock when I shared my key priorities and that sort of thing. And then was able to, over the course of the months that this was being negotiated, share things like why it's important for places like the Kansas 3rd because of the General Motors plant. In Fairfax, because of the medical suppliers that we have here in the Kansas Third who have felt the impact of the chip shortage, and just highlighting the ways that we need to ensure that our small and medium-sized manufacturers are able to access and make use of the provisions that are in the bill.
So it's my understanding the United States used to make more of these semiconductor chips, and then our manufacturing went way down. And the purpose of this bill is to get that to come back to our country, to take it away from China, so that we're producing that commodity here in this country. So will there be incentives to companies then to do that? Is that the way it's going to work?
Yeah. So one, you're absolutely right. The United States used to make quite a few of the semiconductor chips. And over the years, we have essentially, we don't make any of the most advanced semiconductor chips that are the kind that are needed for things like our phones, our cars, medical equipment, and that sort of thing. And so what we've done is ensured that the domestic manufacturing of these kinds of chips and of investing in the workers are that those barriers that sometimes exist are lessened or eliminated, and then making sure that we're allowing for things like prevailing wage requirements in the construction. You know, we just recently attracted to Kansas the Panasonic battery manufacturing, and that's going to be a huge impact on the local economy. And at the same time, we need to make sure the people who are in that plant are not only paid well and safe, but that their families are taken care of. And so I think that if we want to continue to attract Panasonic type projects, not just to our region, but make sure those are happening in the United States, we have to make sure that the entire community is benefiting from that. So investing in things like training, in innovation, the education, which is going to be critical if we're going to, you know, again, long-term compete against countries like China.
We just got a little bit of time left, so we're going to close out, but we really want to say thank you to Congresswoman Charisse Davids for being with us on the Heartland and Labor Forum tonight. We really appreciated you bringing us up to date on some of those important pieces of legislation that's passed in the Congress. And thank you so much for your service and for being with us this evening.
Thank you. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Understanding Israel-Palestine airs every Friday morning, 9:30 to 10, here on KKFI. Interviews with scholars, policy experts, journalists, and activists focus on this century-long struggle for peace and justice, where realities are too complex for sound bites and too important to ignore. So join us here on Understanding Israel-Palestine, Friday mornings from 9:30 to 10.
Did you know that you could donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI Radio and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling KKFI at 816-931-3122 and ask for the development director.
To celebrate my state with you good people. It's a state of which I'm rightly proud. It's full of wide open spaces and magical places. I'd gladly sing its praises long and loud. When folks remember their vacation trip to Denver and the longest stretch of road they'd ever seen. From the Kansas City fountains to the Colorado mountains, well, Kansas is that farm that's in between. And the snow never melts out here in Kansas. At least that's what us Kansas people say. The wind just blows it back and forth from Oklahoma to Nebraska, and it never melts, just kind of wears away. Hey, the cowgirls sure are pretty out in Kansas, with golden hair and gentle country ways, which is quite an inspiration out in this part of the nation, where a cowboy might not see a girl for days. A lonely cowboy, he will often get to dreaming about those cowgirls, and the best part of his dream is how they fits into their britches, which is true, the only hitch is that they're just a doggone few and far between. And the snow.
The Kansas AFL-CIO is a state federation of labor representing over 85,000 members of 300 unions throughout Kansas. The Kansas AFL-CIO is a key part of the nation's largest and strongest labor federation, the AFL-CIO, which unites 12.5 million working women and men of every race and ethnicity from every walk of life. On tonight's show, we will speak with John Nave, Executive Vice President of the Kansas AFL-CIO. He'll tell us how the Inflation Reduction Act will help union workers and all working people in Kansas. Judy and I want to welcome you back to the Heartland Labor Forum, John.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me again. It's good to see everyone and good to be a part of the community and all those out there listening this evening.
Yes, good to see you. It's been, I think, May when we last saw each other, but good to have you back on the program.
Yes.
Let's just start with kind of a general overview. So what are the positive parts of the Inflation Reduction Act as you see it, John?
Well, first, it's some of the best legislation that has been crafted and passed, written in decades. I mean, decades, because what it does, it provides so many things for working families, and to go through it all, it would take a long time to explain, but I'm going to touch on just a few, dealing with health care, prescription drugs, climate change, low energy job, you know, manufacturing jobs, everything. What tax credits for small business, it covers so many things. I like the fact that our president said, let's get a bipartisan approach to it, and they were able to do it. See, when they were able, that's what we want as working families, when they both sides work together and come to an agreement on what's good for working families. So some of the things that, you know, for I like in healthcare is that the premiums will go down for working families, okay? But also in every sector of these changes, jobs are being created. Good paying jobs, union jobs, prescription drugs. You're going to need, it's going to have benefits with lower cost, which means people getting the health care that they need, which means they get back to work or they get well, okay? Climate change. From all across the sector with businesses, big and small, those tax incentives will come into play. Also creating jobs, because of that, jobs are going to be created, okay? And then one of the things that I like, the fact that is that the tax credits, small business, so there's over 250,000 small businesses in the state of Kansas, which makes up 99%. Of the total businesses, those tax credits will come back to benefit them. But the key is doing their due diligence and getting those. You have to do your homework. You have to take part in what the requirements are. Cross your T's, dot your I's, and those tax credits will save you thousands of dollars. In the meantime, that helps put people to work as well.
So the one thing I read that I thought was really interesting, some of those tax credits will go, like you said, to fight climate change, like for the electric vehicles and things like that. But it said that if you're a company and you also adhere to prevailing wage laws, you're going to even get extra incentives.
Yes, absolutely. Those, I mean, those are the good meat of the bill, is that when you do the little things, there's more. There's more to it. You know, low-cost, you know, housing tax credits. A lot of people don't realize people that project homes and apartments, they all, you know, the people that own them get all those tax credits. Okay? So if I own a six-plex apartment building and I do all the energy
requirements, energy-efficient kind of stuff.
Those,
windows.
Yeah, windows. heating, you know, the furnaces and the wind, everything, those credits come back to me at the end of, you know, the next year. So when people look into those kind of things, small businesses thrive, and they pay well, they pay their people well, and it keeps their business, it keeps the doors open.
And then, like you said, that's also going to create jobs, the folks putting those windows in and doing that work. That's great. Mm-hmm.
It's going to help everyone across the board.
Yes.
Would you say that's a once-in-a-lifetime law?
For now?
For our lifetime, maybe?
For now, yes, I would. That's why we continue to, it goes off into the political side, but when we put a president in that talks about working families, that puts the word of unions out there in every conversation, well, we need to be paying attention to that as union members, because he is recognizing unions and what they do for every city, every community across the country. We built this country, and we're doing the work, and then he recognizes that. And so that's the kind of person, that's what we need. I mean, that's the kind of person we want leading our country. For me, it's about the issues of labor, you know, prevailing wage, safety in the workplace, recognition, self-respect, pensions.
A good hourly wage.
A good hourly wage. And when we get that, you get the best crafts out there doing the work. Okay?
This is a very important piece of legislation, and it helps all Americans, but specifically looking at Kansas workers, would you go into depth on that?
Well, for Kansas workers, matter of fact, I got a whole segment on that. Well, in good paying jobs, okay, we know over 23,000 Kansas workers employed in clean energy. Mm. Okay. That will expand those opportunities to a $10 million investment, $1 billion investment, larger on large scale clean power generation and storage. See, up to 2030. So all that from there in is more jobs. It creates opportunity for young folks, apprenticeship programs. I don't know if you've read, the governor signed the bill the other day for this Washburn Tech re-apprenticeship programs. See, so those are the kind of things that's bringing into opportunities for young folks or other tech jobs, high quality jobs.
Mm-hmm. Career building.
Career, absolutely. So we have the opportunity to continue to expand that job market all across the state of Kansas. So yes, we're happy that this is the kind of good legislation that's going to provide for working families all across the state. And in those cities that talk about prevailing wage, you know, we must get that bill, those kind of legislation on the books and get it passed. But it's going to take all of us forcing them to do that.
So in the Inflation Reduction Act, does it actually provide incentives for apprenticeships? I think I read that it does, that it actually will also provide incentives to come.
Well, yes, it does, because what happens, those incentives are geared, presented to the $1 billion investment to the state of Kansas, which then the legislature and the governor then target that revenue or that money to apprenticeship programs. That's exactly why she put in place that department that she did.
And once again, apprenticeships are careers.
Yes.
Good paying jobs so they can support their families, have a retirement, and enjoy the middle class life.
Yes, and I kind of tell the story. I have a niece that she became an IBEW electrical worker.
Oh, okay.
And she did her apprenticeship program 5 years, and now she's a journeyman. But she has a wonderful career, and she's doing really well.
Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're talking to John Nave, the Kansas AFL-CIO Executive Vice President, and we're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. So let's talk a little bit about senior citizens, retirees.
I think it appears to me they're going to benefit quite a bit from the Inflation Reduction Act. So can you, you talked a little bit about the prescription drugs. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yes. What it does, it provides a lower cost for medicine, you know, across the board up to 30, you know, a flat fee of $35 a month for, you know, for prescription drugs. And other benefits, it just, insulin, for example, it caps it.
Right, I think that's the $35 a month, right?
Yes.
If I'm on insulin and I'm on Medicare, I will not pay more than $35 a month for my insulin.
Yeah, and for working for senior citizens, that's some of the most important needs is health. You know, prescription drug costs is such high.
It's a big part of their monthly budget.
Yes, it
is. Some of them can't eat because they have to choose between food and their prescriptions.
And there are programs out there. Now with this bill being passed, we're going to be able to help lower those costs because of that.
And it's my understanding Medicare will now be able to actually negotiate those drug prices, which, and next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're actually going to hear from Richard Fiesta, who's with the Alliance for Retired Americans. Uh-huh. And I thought it was interesting. He said that it's taken us a long time to get that right. We've been fighting to get that negotiating power for Medicare, but he said it was basically Big Pharma that kept us from doing it. And finally, we've been able to get that, which is pretty amazing, I think.
Yes.
It's been years in the making.
Yes. Big Pharma has been just horrendous on working families and seniors. And because of, you know, the senior citizens, it's the fact that we have their children who are union members and working families that help them. Because we did that, you know, with our mom, you know, and making sure she had her medicine. But yes, it is something that has been needed for a long time. And we still got much more work to do, but this is a really big start to supply, help seniors lower the cost of prescription drugs.
Well, I heard Biden speak on Labor Day, and I know he mentioned, because the $35 per month insulin only does apply, I think, to people on Medicare or senior citizens, but I think there's a goal to get it eventually for everybody so that no one will have to pay more than $35 a month.
That's going to be the key is working with the other side, making sure those that support this whole package, those that passed it, we've seen in the past where a few senators didn't come on board, And this is where we need everybody passing this bill and understand that the message to the American people, in particular Kansans, is that watch what they do. Because if they're not doing what they're supposed to, they're not supposed to be there in the first place. And that's our job to hold them accountable.
Right.
Whether you're on the Missouri side or the Kansas side.
Mm-hmm. Part of their job is to look out for the citizens. And not so much corporations.
That is correct.
I just want to add, and one other for the retirees, does it include a cap on the amount of, I think it's a $2,000 cap now on the amount of money per year you would spend on medication, which I know still sounds like a lot, but prior to this, there was no cap. I mean, you could spend $10,000 or $100,000.
And that bites into your budget.
Right.
And so with them putting a cap on it, it helps the senior citizens, it helps working families that we so they can afford to eat and take their medicine.
Right, right.
You know.
Kind of have a little bit more of an enjoyable life.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In their sunset.
Yes. Yep.
There's also a large investment in reducing the amount of carbon that the U.S. produces. Would you talk about that?
Which comes to electric vehicles.
Correct. Oh, gosh, tell me about that, my electric bill.
Yes. Technology's here. We have to accept that, okay? And you're going to see more and more electric cars on the roads. You're going to see more and more electric trucks on the roads and driverless trucks. Mm-hmm. So that's climate change. We have to reduce that in our environment because if we don't, our generations to come will suffer behind that. And now we're seeing that in the weather patterns, right?
Yep.
We're seeing it. And so if we need to make sure that corporations understand, which they don't, well, we got to hold them accountable because they're the ones that are putting it out there. Okay, so we have to hold them. We have to hold them accountable on that aspect of, you know, climate change, clean energy, what's going into the air, but also prepare for the future. Prepare our technology is here.
And specifically for Kansas, they have wind rolling across Kansas from west to east. That's a job producer.
Yes, it is. Energy. You know, the big plane, when you see, I had some friends driving on the highway in southern Kansas, and all they saw was the big
windmills.
Yeah, the big windmills. And but hey, they provide jobs and electricity and energy.
Clean energy.
Clean energy.
Which we've got to go to, or we're not going to have a planet at some point.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think there was something in the Inflation Reduction Act about taxes that I wanted to bring up, because I think it actually is going to require corporations to pay a minimum 15%, and some of them pay 0% at this point, right?
Yes. I wished it was more, but it's a start.
Right.
I tell people, big corporation is the wealthy 1%. They can't take it with them. Okay? And that's my kind of stories. They can't take it with them. But pay your fair share, because it's always, the last 40 years, it's been on the backs of the working class. Okay? And so we deserve some of the tax breaks. Working families, they need to pay their fair share. That's all we're asking. We're not asking to pay it all. Just pay your fair share.
Mm-hmm.
And take it off the backs of the working families.
And a lot of us pay more than 15%.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
So 15%
absolutely.
Is a pretty minimum.
We used to be able to have so many different tax exemptions when your house, you could write off. Now it's hardly anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's hardly nothing. And that's a shame.
Well, I have to say, I personally like that we're starting to make sure every corporation pays at least something of a fair share, as opposed to paying zero.
Yeah.
So that was one that I very much approve of myself.
That's the problem over on the Kansas side. You know, the House and the Senate both always wanting to give more and more tax breaks to the big businesses. And then they keep doing that. And then who's going to pay the difference? Well, we pay the working families. And that's not right. And then where's the budget goes? One thing I like about in the state of Kansas right now, the budget is up, plus surplus, like record. Okay? We haven't had this in years. We haven't had a budget like this in years. When you have a rainy day fund of almost $1 billion in the rainy day fund, and then a surplus almost $1 billion, hey, somebody's doing something right.
Good right. things are happening.
Exactly.
So the name of this is the Inflation Reduction Act. So how is it going to cut inflation, do you think?
Well, it's a craft that you buy what you need, and you reinvest. You know, companies reinvest into the market. Spend your money wisely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think families are already knowing that now. They're doing it. They're cutting back. But they're also managing their money. And they're still doing the quality of life. So people are watching that.
Paying attention.
And
is there anything in that act that you wished had been in there that was not placed in it? Or anything you wish they'd gone further on?
For me, I would have been like the PRO Act and more of stuff dealing with working families, labor issues. You know, if they would have passed more of that, of the PRO Act,
Why don't you tell everybody about a little bit, because not everybody may know what the PRO Act is.
Well, it's talking about...
Just real quickly, I'm sorry, okay. Running out of time.
Well, it's just talking about advantages of being in the union and the right to organize.
Right.
It levels the playing field.
It levels the playing
field. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, John Nave, for being with us tonight, Executive Vice President of the Kansas AFL-CIO.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciated your knowledge and insight into the Inflation Reduction Act.
Well, and the last thing I'll say is the listeners out there on the Kansas side, pay attention to what's going on in the House and Senate on both the Missouri side and the Kansas side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Those that write the rules.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
John.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Blockman of IBW 124. Tonight I'm going to speak to you about the now infamous PATCO strike. Many younger union members wonder why older members are nervous of striking. We were not old enough to have lived through the PATCO strike. PATCO is the certified union representing air traffic controllers working at airports across the United States. Air traffic controllers are employed by the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, and are therefore government employees. PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, was founded in 1968 as a trade association. However, rather quickly it became clear that airlines were cutting corners on safety by pressuring air traffic controllers to allow airplanes to fly closer than the minimum safe standards established by the FAA. PATCO began engaging in a type of slowdown called a work to rule. Today, you'll see business publications refer to this old labor tactic as quiet quitting and refuse to violate safety rules any longer. This resulted in the U.S. Civil Service Commission ruling that PATCO had ceased to operate as a trade association and had instead become a trade union. The newly designated trade union was in a tough spot. While government employees had a right to a union, it was illegal for them to strike, and they had made an oath that they would not strike upon taking the job. This severely limited the bargaining power of their union and narrowed their tactical options significantly. PATCO members decided to respond to the mounting unrealistic demands of the FAA with a sick out. On March 25, 1970, 2,000 air traffic controllers from all across the country called in sick. After a month and a half, a federal court ordered the sick workers back to their job, but also forced the government back to the bargaining table. The FAA recognized that they were operating the air traffic controller system with dangerously low staff levels, forcing incredibly long shifts upon workers who were already inherently highly stressed due to their high-stakes job. Pay was raised moderately, the training of new air traffic controllers was accelerated, and the FAA increased the conversion rate of some systems over to automation. By the 1980 presidential election, the pay increase was largely eroded, and working conditions had deteriorated further. Almost all unions endorsed the Democratic candidate, Jimmy Carter, but PATCO, along with the Airline Pilots Association and the Teamsters, chose instead to endorse Ronald Reagan. Reagan had himself been a union member for years as an actor with the Screen Actors Guild and had even served as SAG's president through six re-elections. PATCO's endorsement was in fact courted by Reagan in a letter he sent to PATCO's president, Robert Polley. In it, Reagan stated, "I will take whatever steps are necessary to provide our air traffic controllers with the most modern equipment available and to adjust staff levels and workdays so that they are commensurate with achieving the maximum degree of public safety, as well as, I pledge to you that my administration will work very closely with you to bring about a spirit of cooperation between the president and the air traffic controllers." With such an enthusiastic declaration of support, it is likely PATCO expected a fair bit of presidential support in future negotiations with the FAA, and this sense of security probably contributed to their subsequent decision to strike. PATCO negotiations reopened again in February of 1981, but had broken down by June. PATCO was asking for a 32-hour work week, a four-day week with eight-hour days, a $10,000 raise, and a better benefits package for their retirement. The government offered a pay raise it claimed was twice that being offered to other government employees, but no reduced work weeks and no improved retirement benefits. PATCO declined. On August 3rd, PATCO voted to strike. Their demands included their 32-hour work week, better retirement packages, and a pay increase of $600 million over 3 years, as opposed to the government's offer of $40 million over the same period. Another reason the air traffic controllers likely felt more powerful than the political moment proved them to actually be is their belief in their irreplaceability. Their skill sets were unusual and highly in demand, with many of them having gained them through military service in Vietnam and other conflicts. To replace them would take years, and surely the government couldn't make do without all 13,000 of them. Unfortunately, they were wrong. Under the Taft-Hartley Act and other federal laws, President Reagan ordered them back to work. Only 1,300 of the 13,000 complied. President Reagan then gave the ultimatum that the striking workers would either return to work within 48 hours or else they would be fired, blacklisted from ever working for the federal government again, and potentially be prosecuted. At the end of the 2 days, 11,345 air traffic controllers were fired. By the end of the year, PATCO had been decertified. The FAA expected to replace the missing controllers within 2 years, but instead it took 10. Even when President Bill Clinton lifted the ban on strikers in 1993, only 10% of former strikers were ever rehired by the FAA. In the wake of the PATCO strike, things were different for unions. Union opponents felt emboldened by the high-profile defeat, and unionists were left shaken. It would take almost 2 decades before the labor movement would begin to recover its confidence again, but a look at this year's total number of union elections show that we are well on our way. Have a great evening, everyone.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Join a labor canvas for Missouri candidates Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays through September in various places. To register, call Carson at 214-927-2812. And I will repeat that, I will state that our calendar is on our Facebook page. So if you want to get any of these numbers or links, you can go to the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Second annual Take a Kid Fishing Day, Saturday, September 10th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Troost Lake Shelter, 3036 The Paseo in Kansas City, sponsored by the Union Sportsmen's Alliance. Bring a kid. UU Forum kicks off the season with Defending the Flame of Democracy with Ann Calvert and Janet Milkovich of Local Leagues of Women Voters. Sunday, September 11th, 9:30 a.m., Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut in Kansas City, Conover Hall, and also online. This is a hybrid event. You can find the link at UU Forum at by emailing uuforum at allsoulskc.org. This is a new time and in-person hybrid, masks and vaccination required. Labor Notes, Secrets of a Successful Organizer September Training Series kicks off on September 14th and goes for 3 weeks, the 21st and the 28th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. To register, go to labornotes.org and select events. Topics are Beating Apathy, Assembling Your Dream Team, and Turning an Issue into a Campaign. Working Families Friend annual picnic and barbecue will be September 24th at Pipefitters Local 533, 8600 Hillcrest. You can register at wffriend.org. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We're going to have an interview with the National Alliance for Retired Americans, which it has opened up a new chapter in Kansas, and what liberals get wrong about the New Deal, an alternative history lesson. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Stephen Hill. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Shots in the Night's Radio Theater.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum, KKFI, at gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. He said if I were Frank Sinatra, I'd pull strings. And through political bull, you'd be on top of the glorified garbage pile with all of their plastic smiles. You'd be with all the self-appointed kings. to struggle.